This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order. The time is 3:18 p.m. on April 4th. Members present are Representative Carrick, Representative Cologne, Representative Burke, Representative Sadler, Representative Nelson, and myself, Co-Chair Hall. We have a quorum. Please silence your cell phones. We're asking that staff and members of the audience not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to one of the committee members, please do so by getting the attention of our committee aide, Tristan Walsh, and he will take care of it. I'd like to thank Nicole Bearden, the Labor and Commerce Committee Secretary, and Zach Lawhorn from the Juno LAO for tech and teleconferencing support. Thank you so much. On today's calendar, we have the second hearing for House Bill 148, an omnibus insurance bill, as well as the second hearing for House Bill 60 regarding the Alaska Grown procurement preference. Our intent today is to let members ask questions of the administration and get answers for these bills. So with that, we're going to be starting with House Bill 148 regarding numerous insurance fixes for the administration. And we have here available for questions Director Lori Winghier and also Deputy Director Heather Carpenter. Thank you very much for being here and available. So kicking things off, does anybody have questions for the Deputy Director Carpenter after that lengthy sectional analysis that we had recently that was so very well done? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was the one. I'm not going to presume to ask detailed questions about the nuances of any of those sections, but I guess kind of for the public watching this large bill and for members of the legislature watching as well, two general questions. What happens if we don't pass this bill? Are there any? So that's the question would be, what are the must-haves? If we must pass it, what are the must-haves and what are the not-so-must-haves? And what happens if we don't pass any of it? How's that for a broad framing of the consequences?
Through the chair, my name is Lori Winghier. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska, and through the chair to Representative Sadler's question. There are a few sections that are related to our accreditation, and our accreditation, of course, is where we are judged that we are examining the financial status of insurance companies in line with the other 55 jurisdictions that are members of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. What that does is it says that the companies in Alaska, Alaska National, and Umalic in particular, can do business in other states, and the commissioner in that state can say that that company is solvent because we've done the exam to the same standards. Not only do we follow the same handbook to do those standards, but then we are examined ourselves to make sure that our work is stands up to those standards and is either meets or exceeds the work, the criteria for being accredited. So there are a few sections in the bill that deal with updates to the accreditation standards. As for the rest of the bill, some of it is licensing, which I think Deputy Director has had her hands on more than I have, and that is updating our licensing to be a little bit more efficient and address some areas where we found we were not licensing people that should have been licensed adjusters in the state. We also were correcting some of the text that has been in our statute for a long time. They're technical changes. Those are quite a few throughout the bill. So overall, if we didn't pass the bill, we would ask for it again to come back. These are fixes that we need throughout the Title 21. There is no one, I would say, that is more important than the other, taking out of that the accreditation standards. But they are fixes that the staff, over course of time, feels that we need to be more efficient and more effective and protect consumers better.
Okay. Representative Cologne, then Representative Sadler.
I can let him finish.
Okay. No. Representative Sadler?
Thank you. And just to follow up on the question through the chair, Director Winghier, the sections dealing with accreditation, could you enumerate them by chance? And again, please don't understand, I'm not telegraphing that I want to kill everything, but these sections, I'm just trying to, with the large, complicated bill, just trying to see what's most important for the continuation of good insurance practice in
Section
Alaska.
4, Section 4? 5. Section 8, Section 9, Section 10, Section 11, I believe those are the ones, Representative Sadler, through the chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Clum.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Hall. So this kind of follow-up to that. So any section or in your sexual analysis when it says to align with NAIC Model Law 786, is that kind of cue for an accreditation issue, or is there other reasons to model the law?
Through the chair to Representative Clum. Model law, the reason we do it like that is because insurance companies, they're nationwide. You're going to find State Farm, Allstate, Liberty, AIG, and other companies that write in all 50 states. They want to see that our laws are similar, if not identical, so that they're not having to say, well, what's different in Alaska than different in Arkansas than different in Texas as to California. So a lot of the times at the NAIC, we do develop the model laws, and we act very much like the legislature, where we have committees. We start with one committee. We bring it up into the plenary, if you will, to vote on should we adopt that in our states, and we bring it back to the legislature to adopt. It's much like we've seen bills come up from NCOIL, the National Council of Insurance Legislators, same thing, where they act much like the legislature. They debate bills and then bring them forward for plenary and bring back to the states to adopt. Those on the one bill you're talking, though, I believe that is a licensing bill. Yeah, that bill number is a licensing bill. And so if you have a specific question, Deputy Director would answer that.
That's good.
Okay. Representative Carrick, followed by Representative Burke. Adios. We're back on record. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, Chair Hall. I really appreciate that. I know there was a little bit of concern on the controlled insurance program cleanup language that's in this bill.
The owner controlled, just to be clear?
The controlled insurance programs in Alaska, I'm reading from an email that I have about this. Restrict the use of CIPs to projects valued at $50 million or more. Is that part of this legislation? Can you point to what section that's in, first of all?
Through the chair, I will let the deputy director find the section, but I can explain what that is. The current statutes, and this goes back to many years ago when the state was in a lawsuit with Alyeska, and the concern was over an owner-controlled insurance program, and the current statutes that we have are a result of that lawsuit. Well, what the statute says is that to have an owner-controlled insurance program or a contractor-controlled insurance program, it has to be approved by the division. It has to be over $50 million. It has to have a definitive length of time, and it has to have a definitive location. So a couple of years ago, we were approached about an owner-controlled insurance program, and in reviewing it with our legal team, they did not think that I could approve a program because our statute was not written correctly. I don't think the intent coming out of the court case was ever to say you couldn't have one, but what it said in the statute was that we couldn't add an additional insured. Well, that's the reason to have one of these programs, because what they are is that either the owner or the general contractor buys insurance for the entire project, all the subs, the workers' compensation, the general liability, the equipment. So that's why it has to have a defined period, a defined location. And they buy the insurance for every contractor on that site, including architects and engineers. It saves money for large projects. So again, the major projects has to be over $50 million. We went into the statute, what the original bill says, is that we corrected it to say that you could have additional insureds. That took out the problem that we think was an error when the statute was first passed. What has come up and is floating around the Capitol right now is an amendment for multi-residential. The multi-residential, and this just passed over on the Senate, they have asked to have be addressed to have a lesser limit than $50 million to allow for multi-residential projects only. So what passed in the other body was $25 million. It has to be 50 units, and it has to have at least three owners. and it did pass the other body and will come over here at some point. So it is being addressed. I know that what was floating around the Capitol, there was a version for a $5 million limit and a $10 million limit, and that's the cost of construction for the whole project. And the division in working with insurance companies and with brokers, we feel that that is too low, that it would pull it would almost qualify anything to be a contractor controlled or an owner controlled, and it would pull too much out of the standard market so that contractors that weren't under an OSIP or a CSIP wouldn't be able to provide insurance, that it would be harder to get for them. I mean, insurance companies aren't going to stand around stay in Alaska to write, if you will, just really small contractors, because the majority of the businesses would be in these OSIPs or these CSIPs. So there was an arrive limit over in the other body. It was $25 million. That passed today.
And just a quick follow-up?
Follow-up.
And does the, through the chair to Director Winghire, does the revised threshold of $25 million, is that still potentially too low? Or is that probably a good compromise, in your opinion?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, in my opinion, that's a fair compromise. We were happy with 20 or 25 million. What came out was 25, and we're satisfied with it.
Okay.
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Representative Burke.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hall. Through the chair, I think this is a question. Follow up on a question that I asked before to Deputy Director Carpenter. It's about Section 6, the wet marine transportation contracts were previously excluded, and then again, and then follow up in Section 62, the repealer of that. Just curious, why there was an exclusion before. In the repealer, it says that the state of Alaska is losing roughly $300,000 in tax revenue per year as written. I'm just curious why it was written that way.
Through the chair to Representative Burke, frankly, that goes back years. And why they were given the exclusion or the exemption, we don't know. It goes back years and years in our statute. It may have been when the Title 21 was first adopted, which we adopted a lot from Oregon and Montana, if you read back. And it may have been that it was in theirs, and we just adopted it.
Thank you.
And just for the record, Heather Carpenter, Deputy Director, through the chair, Rep. Burke, this was one of the questions we provided a written answer to earlier this week. So,
sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, following up to Director Winghire from Representative Carrick's questions. So I guess just to understand the market a little better, you mentioned that the proposed much lower limits for the owner-controlled and contractor-controlled insurance programs were too low. You thought they would chase businesses out or insurers out of Alaska. Are there businesses whose business line is large, you know, OSIP, CSIP, use the term, or who would this drive out of business?
Through the chair, I want to correct. I'm not saying it's going to drive them out of business, but insurance companies have minimum premiums, and they have standards as to, I mean, you could talk to any small business, and they're limited in who will write their insurance. And if you take out too much payroll or revenue out of small contractors, they're going to have a harder time finding somebody to write them. And that was our concern in looking at multi-residential and going down to what we thought was too low of a limit, $5 or $10
million. Okay, great. Thank you for that.
I have a couple of questions. So, Director Winghire, I'm curious, with Section 53 having to do with the depreciation of labor, I know Deputy Director Carpenter talked about that the other day, but I'm curious, why was depreciation of labor allowed in the first place? Because that just seems like maybe it's another one of those ghosts from Christmas past that kind of like we're just, yeah.
And Madam Chair, I'll take responsibility for this. We missed it when it came in a few policy forms that they were depreciating labor. It had not been done, and then all of a sudden it was in a policy form. And as you may know, my staff reviews all policy forms, be it health, life, or property and casualty. And we missed when there was a clause that said we're going to depreciate labor in actual cash value policies and some in replacement cost. So we started to get complaints or concerns. And we then started talking to our colleagues in other states of were they seeing this and how were they dealing with it. And there were a variety of opinions. And slowly but surely, you're starting to see states adopt measures to address the depreciation of labor. We put it, as you're seeing before you, into our bill and said that we were just going to not allow it. We did run into some resistance on it. We worked with the American Property and Casualty Insurance Association. And in the other body today, they adopted an amendment that will allow for depreciation of labor, but it's kind of a two-step thing. The policy that you get, and it will only be residential, will not allow for depreciation of labor. But your broker or agent or whomever you're working with to purchase the insurance can offer you a standalone endorsement saying that the labor will be depreciated, but it also has to tell you if you're going to save any money for that. So if you are under constraints and they say your homeowner's policy is $1,000, but if you want to, if you will accept labor depreciated, you can get it for $850, then you have a choice to make. And you could purchase that policy for $850, knowing that in the event of a claim, labor will be depreciated.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Julie. Okay, so you can basically lower your premium by taking a higher deductible or lower coverage limits. That's just one more factor of the equation you can agree to take a little hit on in order to make it more affordable. Kind of.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that's exactly what we agreed to.
Okay. Seeing no other questions from the committee, I have another question. So Section 58, could you, having to do with health maintenance organizations or HMOs, can you give a little bit of the history of that and how big of an issue it is or has been?
Madam Chair, it's not an issue.
Okay.
But what we did is we have allowed HMOs or health maintenance organizations in this state for years and years and years, but there's no teeth to them. And a health maintenance organization is basically managed care. And Kaiser Permanente in California is probably one we've all read about at one point or another. Because of the high cost of health care and to try and help employers, we put a little bit of the teeth back into our statute. It's not a mandate. It's not saying that an employer has to have an HMO. It's not saying that an insurance company has to offer it. But what it is saying is that if it's going to save the employer some money or the employee who pays a portion of their own premium, we think it should be back on the books as an alternative or an option for employers' employees to, again, reduce costs. It won't change the benefits, but it is a little bit more of the managed care.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Representative Sadler?
Thank you. You mentioned through the chair, Director, the other places, other amendments in the building that would affect this bill, the broad title insurance. I know there's a couple different issues in healthcare, and we talk about HMO coverage. Are there any other, riders, hitchhikers, policy additions that this bill you've heard may attract or has attracted in other versions elsewhere in the building?
Through the chair, it passed out of the other body, or the committee it was in, and with the two amendments that I talked about, the depreciation of labor and the change to the owner-controlled insurance program. We have heard of a couple of amendments that possibly Rep. Fields will offer, but I have not seen any amendments to know that they're coming or not, so I can't really comment any further.
And the reason I asked you the chair
follow-up
is just that I've heard efforts to try and repeal the 80 percentile rule. There's other health insurance issues. I can see that this is a big bill, and people may think that it could snag a few more little subtle things that would make it even better. I just wonder if you heard anything, so thank you for that. No question.
Okay. All right. Additional questions from the committee? Hearing and seeing none, thank you both so very much
thank
for
you.
Making yourself available and sharing your expertise. Thank you. Next up, we have House Bill 60 about the Alaska Grown Procurement Preference. We're going to have a brief recap on the bill since it's been quite a while since we last heard this piece of legislation. And following that, we'll have time for questions from the committee. And I want to preface this particular conversation just with a bigger context and discussion of that the House is having surrounding House Bill 140, which is to create a Department of Agriculture. So I thought it might be helpful just to dig into this bill a little bit and have it back before us to ask any questions with that broader context. So, Deputy Commissioner Latham, thank you so very much for making yourself available. We appreciate it. Would you please identify yourself for the record and share a brief reminder of what the bill is about?
Absolutely. Good afternoon.
Chairman Hall and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Anna Latham. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Thank you for bringing up House Bill 60 again today. House Bill 60 makes some very incremental changes to a Department of Administration procurement statute that's been on the books since 1986. State agencies, municipalities, and school districts are required to purchase Alaska-grown products or fisheries products that are harvested in-state if they're within 7% of the cost of out-of-state products and they're available. And they have a permissible clause that allows them to purchase those same products up to 15% higher than what's offered out-of-state if they're available. This bill makes changes for the requirement from 7 to 10%, and then for the permissible amount from 15 to 25%.
Great. Thank you. Representative Klum.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Hall. So I noticed that the fiscal notes are zero, so it doesn't look like it's going to cost the department. But by raising this percentage, it's definitely going to be more expensive for school districts and municipalities, correct, potentially?
Representative Klum, through the chair, that's correct. If the products that are grown in state are more expensive, yes. But I have reached out to the Department of Education. They're co-located. We share a commissioner's office between Department of Commerce and Education. We're on the ninth floor of the state office building. I've reached out to them just after a few hearings in the Senate. There was that same question about costs. And I've also reached out to the Alaska Municipal League regarding that same question.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just a comment. I want to support Alaska Grown, but this will have impact on you know, local government, so it's something to consider.
Okay. Well, Representative Carrick, then Representative Sadler.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair and Director Latham, I saw something the other day that said Alaskans are willing to pay something like $1.60 more on average for Alaska-grown products in the grocery stores versus other products, and that's just more of a comment. I think that's really interesting. But I also would agree that even if it is a slightly more expensive cost, that it's good for the state to take a position of purchasing Alaska-grown products where available. So I largely support the idea of this bill. But I do want to ask you to clarify again whether it's a requirement for if there is a product that falls within this threshold. Is it a requirement for purchase to go with the Alaska-grown product, or is it still a choice, and this is just saying you can be reimbursed up to this higher threshold? That was my question.
Representative Carrick, through the chair, it is a requirement for state agencies, municipalities, and school districts that use the contract that the Department of Administration has. And that master contract is with U.S. Foods. So if those products are available and listed on the U.S. Foods contract, they do have to purchase them. And there's very few products currently listed.
Yeah.
I did some just preliminary perusing of the U.S. Foods contract. And in January, when I started looking at it, there were, I think, potatoes and one other item listed. I think lettuce was the other thing that was listed. But there's very little that's actually available at this time. And if I may just say that the reason that this bill, one of the reasons this bill was introduced was it was a recommendation of the Food Security Task Force. And there was a need to provide growers in state that wanted to ramp up their production and entry to the commercial markets. And this was the recommendation to get there so that they could ramp up their production, grow more in state, and have a buyer.
Follow up.
And I think you might have just answered the question, but through the chair, is it that there's products that are just not available at any cost, like, say, lettuce growers? We don't have any lettuce growers, as an example. Or is it that they're not within this price threshold? And I think you kind of just answered that question. We're hoping to stimulate a market to grow up knowing that they'll be able to fit within this differential easier than they could within the current differential. Could you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. There's very little data on pricing in state because there's so few products available. So the intent of this is to provide entry to growers that are interested in ramping up their production. They can't necessarily sow an additional 5 acres of potatoes unless they know they have a buyer, and this would provide a buyer. The division of the Department of Corrections is one of the biggest purchasers right now for the U.S. food contracts of Alaska-grown products. And I did provide a presentation to this committee earlier in the year, mm-hmm. and there's just very little that the state purchases overall.
Representative Sadler, do you...
Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Okay. Through the chair, Ms. Latham, I share the other representatives' concerns about the zero fiscal note when we're essentially mandating in some places that municipalities, school districts must buy more expensive products, agricultural products, even though I appreciate the desire to support Alaskan agriculture. But one more statement than a question. Each of the first four sections states that when the state receives state money, I'm not sure. Can you define what that is? Is that just state money for purchase of food? Is it any state money, educational support, transportation money, you know, court system? How broad is that definition of receiving state money from the state?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that is for municipalities and school districts. All school districts receive state funds. I believe all municipalities do as well. I believe that's very broad. There may be someone from Department of Administration online as well that may have additional information about that.
But to clarify before we go there,
follow up.
So that is not limited to just to receiving state money to support purchase of food, right? It's any purpose.
I believe it's broad, but I would lean on Department of Administration to clarify.
Thank you for that reminder. Yes, we do have a couple of folks online available to answer questions. One person who's online is Brooke Cashin, Deputy Chief Procurement Officer with the Department of Administration, and the other person we have online is Sandra Mahler, who's the Director of the Division of Community and Regional Affairs. Brooke Cashin, Ms. Cashin, are you able to answer the question, or do you need the question repeated?
Good afternoon. For the record, this is Brooke Cashin from the Department of Administration. Through the chair to the representative, I think I understood the question. And I believe that, and I probably would want to confirm with the law department just to ensure that I understand the intent of the language, but it is my understanding that it means any agency that receives any state funds.
Representative Cologne?
Yeah, so Ms. Cashin, through the chair, so it's my understanding the food bank receives state funds. Would they be under this requirement as well?
Through the chair, Representative Cologne, honestly, I would need to see if they are part of this master agreement that the Department of Administration has set out. I don't believe that it would be a mandatory contract for a food department or a food bank. I believe that the only mandatory use is the Department of Corrections.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
So you referenced the master agreement from DOA. So initially you said it was any state funds, and now it sounds like it might be tied to a master agreement. Can you tell me what the master agreement from DOA is?
Through the chair, Representative Cologne. Yes. The master agreement is our agreement with U.S. Foods, so the vendor that provides the bulk of state food purchases. So not just Alaskan grown, but any food purchases for agencies. But again, it's only mandatory for some agencies to use this U.S. food contract. Other agencies are able to source and procure foods from other sources.
Oh.
And so currently the data that we have right now for purchases is through this vendor, U.S. Foods. However, to your point, I believe the bill would be a requirement for all purchases and not just through this master agreement.
Okay. All right, that clarifies it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cashin. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And actually, having asked my first two kind of scoping questions, I'll ask Ms. Latham. Are municipalities, school districts, et cetera, running up against the 7% cap right now? Are they simply unable to purchase more Alaska-grown food because the 7% cap exists, or the 7% premium exists?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that is not my understanding after discussing this. I wouldn't speak for the school districts or municipalities themselves, but there has not been that premise. There just hasn't been a lot of produce or fisheries items available state. Alaska imports over 95% of its food.
And to follow up, just kind of talk it out a little
follow
bit.
Up.
So if we allowed an extra 3%, 33% increase in the premium, we would broaden we would expand the financial, I have to think this through. It'd make it easier to buy Alaska products, even if they did cost more. But, that's it.
Additional question, Representative Klum.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, has there been any discussions around availability of these products? So if we only have a couple that would probably qualify, and then all of a sudden all the state agencies that use they're all asking for the lettuce or the potatoes, I don't see anything in the bill that says if it's not available, you can still go to, buy food from out of state. I guess, is there anything that needs to be added to the bill to deal with availability issues?
Representative Klum, through the chair, the U.S. Foods Master Contract has a lot of out-of-state vendors on it currently, mm-hmm. and if, for example, the Department of Corrections needs to purchase potatoes, mm-hmm. they will purchase from those out-of-state vendors if there's not an in-state vendor that currently is within 7% of that price range. If House Bill 60 were to pass, then would be within 10% of that price range.
Follow up. So you're saying in that contract, if the Alaskan grown potatoes aren't available, they're allowed to buy from an outside vendor.
And the Representative Klum, through the chair, the majority of the purchases are out of state goods.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Okay. I have a question. So with this being a recommendation from the Food Security Task Force, or did I get that right, the right title? Okay, thank you. How many growers are poised to make this leap or to want to expand to commercial, quantities?
Representative Hall, through the chair, I don't have an exact number for you. I met with the Farm Bureau earlier this year, and there were handful of growers that came down to Juneau that indicated they could ramp up their production if they had a commercial contract that they could rely on.
Okay. And I guess a follow-up to that is, do you know how, not that you're a grower expert, but do you know how long it would take for them to be able to ramp up? I'm just thinking about seasonally and all that things.
Representative Hall, through the chair, I'd be remiss in answering that question.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Sadler.
It would probably be a factor of how long it would take to get state support to buy more freezers.
Well, and I think that would also lead to another question along the line of food storage and what additional supports would the agricultural industry need to be able to help sustain them commercially?
Yeah, that was so.
Representative Klum.
Through the chair, that's one of the things I was considering was before this. I feel like the effective date might be pretty short. Would you oppose an extension on the effective date to let the agriculture community kind of adapt to what's about to happen? Or
well,
I guess it doesn't matter if it's not available. It's not available.
Representative Klum, through the chair, there's not an effective date, but it's just the amount that they're of the mandatory purchase. So as more products become available, they'll be on the master contract and they'll be available. So I would say that's probably not necessary.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Burke.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hall. Through the chair, I have a question. So I apologize. I can't recall the name of the from the department on the line, but there was a comment about it's only mandatory for some agencies who use U.S. foods, but it also talks about municipalities and school districts who receive state money. Do we know how many municipalities and school districts use U.S. foods?
Representative Burke, that would be best poised for Department of Administration.
Ms. Cashin, thank you. Ms. Cashin, are you able to answer the question?
Through the chair to Representative Burke, I don't have that data immediately, but could get it and send it to the committee members.
Thank you. That would be great. Please do, Ms. Cashin. Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And for this conversation, I believe I heard Ms. Cashin say that these provisions are not limited to those agencies participating in the food agreement. It's all of them. They get state money of any kind. So the master agreement is kind of a red herring, kind of thing. That might be where most of the purchases come through, but that is not a qualifying, factor. Just for the record.
Additional comments or questions from the committee? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, thank you so very much for your time and for making yourself available to us again. We really appreciate it, Deputy Commissioner. Thank you, Ms. Cashin, also for being available, and Ms. Mueller. So with that concludes our business for today. The House Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Monday, April 7th at 3:15 p.m. in Barnes Room 124, when we will take up SB 50 about municipal comprehensive plans and housing, House Bill 171 about interchange fees on tax and gratuity, and House Bill 70 about emergency medical services and operational canines. With that, this meeting is adjourned at 3:55 p.m.